Headlines. Iran says U.S. sanctions have grossly violated the absolute rights of Iranian people to access humanitarian aid. The U.S. is expected to release an intelligence report which says a Saudi crown prince approved the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And at least 16 people are killed and over 50 others injured in an attack by Boko Haram terrorist group in northeast Nigeria. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the head of Iran's judiciary's High Council for Human Rights, says U.S. sanctions have grossly violated the absolute rights of Iranian people to access humanitarian aid.
I speak of a nation whose absolute right, including the right to health, the right to food, the right of access to humanitarian aid, and the right of access to peaceful nuclear technology have been grossly violated by the illegal sanctions imposed by the U.S. regime and its implementations by a number of Western countries.
Ali Bagheri Chani was speaking at a high-level session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva. He noted that sanctions have even deprived Iran of purchasing medicine for children suffering from butterfly disease. Bagheri Chani said the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former U.S. administration has led to maximum violation of the rights of Iranians. He slammed as politically motivated claims of human rights violations made by some Western countries against Iran. Further in his remarks, Bagheri Chani lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for assassinating the country's top general Qasem Soleimani and nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He said such murders show Iran is paying a very hefty price for its fight against terrorism.
The assassination of the greatest defender of the right of nations in the region against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani, by the U.S. regime, and the assassination of our scientists of the field of peaceful nuclear science and technology, including Martyr Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, by the Zionist regime, are but a portion of expenses paid by the Iranian people in the fight against terrorism.
Bagheri Chani further said Iran has been at the forefront of the fight against terrorism, adding that some Western countries have praised the notorious anti-Tehran terror group, the MKO, which has killed thousands of innocent Iranians. Political commentator Ajamu Baraka says U.S. sanctions against Iran amidst the coronavirus pandemic run counter to international norms and rules.
To intensify the sanctions, even within the midst of the corona pandemic, displayed an attitude, a wanton rejection of the value of life in Iran. So it is important that the comments were made today to shift attention back to the illegal and immoral policies of the U.S. That in fact does reflect an attempt to impose collective punishment on innocent people in Iran. The policies of the U.S. are directed toward other nations in the midst of this coronavirus also has violated international human rights norms. So the U.S. has no moral and political standing to be in a place to criticize any country's human rights records. As long as it continues to be what many people believe to be the number one violator of human rights on the planet.
Now the U.S. says it will soon release an intelligence report on the 2018 murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki made the announcement, adding that the U.S. President Joe Biden is also expected to speak with the Saudi Arabian King Salman. Reports say that Khashoggi's murder will be a hot topic during that phone call. A declassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in the journalist's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and fierce critic of the Saudi government's policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul back in October 2018. Political commentator William Beeman says the former U.S. President Donald Trump concealed documents on the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
The Khashoggi murder is a scandal, and it has been hidden by the Trump administration. That is, all of the documentation that was collected was suppressed by the Trump administration, largely because of the personal and, I should say, commercial relationship between Donald Trump and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. Now the Biden administration has come into power, and this documentation will now be unclassified. We're waiting for the documentation to actually be declassified. Avril Haines would be the one to do this, and Ms. Haines has promised to declassify this material as soon as possible. But we know quite a lot about this assassination, and I think that there's general consensus that Mohammed bin Salman was involved in this at some level.
The United Nations says the Israeli regime has total impunity for using excessive use of force against Palestinians. Earlier, we discussed the issue in detail with our guests in our news review program. Now, the UN says Israeli forces have enjoyed persistent impunity for using excessive force against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank.
We also continue to observe persistent impunity afforded to members of the Israeli security forces for incidents of possible excessive use of force in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In the rare cases where convictions have been secured, the charges and sentences have appeared extremely lenient given the gravity of the conduct.
Addressing the human rights, Bachelet said that Israeli forces had killed 67 Palestinians, including 16 children, between November of 2019 and October of 2020. She added that nearly 3,700 others were also injured during the same period. She also criticized Tel Aviv for lack of notable progress in investigating allegations of ill treatment and torture of Palestinian inmates in Israeli prisons. Bachelet said there have been no charges brought against Israelis involved in rights violations. The UN official called on the international community to hold to account those responsible for such violations and provide redress to victims. And now joining us is Angelo John Gage, activist and author from New Jersey, and Jason Unruhe, political commentator, joining us out of Niagara Falls, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Jay, we'll start with you. Your thoughts on this? It's not the first time we've heard condemnations against Tel Aviv, but it's basically all bark. We never see bite. Your thoughts on the story?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the best way to put it. The UN will condemn just about anyone for anything, or condemn Israel for a very real crime against the Palestinian people. Yet in no way, shape, or form do we see anything done about it whatsoever. Guilty people are not held accountable for the crimes they commit. They commit these crimes with impunity. Israel commits these crimes with impunity. And the UN is a completely useless organization when it comes to holding these people accountable. It seems that the only people that the UN actually punishes for any crimes are the odd African warlord here and there, but those who are the biggest violators of human rights, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the United States, etc., they seem to have a free hand to do whatever it is that they want. I find it almost ironically funny in a way that an international organization has to come through and investigate the incident as if the Israeli Defense Force has any credibility in this situation whatsoever. They have repeatedly lied over the decades. They have repeatedly massacred civilians over the last couple decades. It's almost funny that anyone would believe their side of the story off the bat anyway. You know, it's the same thing when somebody lies all the time. You never believe what they say. But it seems to be, in this case, at least Israel can lie about these incidences almost without restraint. I mean, this is the same side that is currently blocking COVID vaccines from reaching the Palestinian people. And when you're literally blocking something like that, a very necessary, you know, medicine for trying to stop what is a worldwide pandemic, one has to question that if the people doing so have any humanity whatsoever.
Strong stuff there. Thank you, Jason. Angelo, I'd like to welcome you to the program, bud. Your initial thoughts on this?
I agree with everything Jason said. I mean, he basically took the words out of my mouth. Israel has been doing such horrible things for decades, including against my own country, the United States of America. You know, Jonathan Pollard going back to Israel as a hero, Benjamin Netanyahu welcoming him back, USS Liberty, all sorts of terrible things, Rachel Corrie as well. So my own country won't even do anything to punish Israel for what's done to us. I don't think anyone in the UN, specifically the US, which has the veto, vote to do anything and just cancel any resolution, whenever it feels like it, will do anything either for the Palestinians, who are basically under siege in open-air concentration camps. I mean, the whole world knows this, and yet nothing is done, just like Jason said. It's absolutely horrifying and sad. But yeah, I mean, if you speak about this, someone like me, been deplatformed on Twitter, they call you an anti-Semite because they expanded the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, now criticizing Israel, is they say it's okay, but no, it's also anti-Semitic because you're attacking the Jewish state, even though there are Jewish people who criticize Israel who they call self-hating Jews. So you won't see many Americans other than a few of us who are brave enough to stand up and say something about Israel, because you will be labeled an anti-Semite. AIPAC, ADL, SPLC, they all come after you, get you fired. So that's why here in America people are silent, not to mention our politicians are also passing laws against BDS and claiming that's anti-Semitic. So you know, it's that's why the world is silent. America is Israel's executive branch to go attack their enemies and silence countries and all that. But that's why you won't hear much, and it's very sad.
Thank you, gentlemen. Time has gotten the better of us, but I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Angelo, John, Gage joining us out of New Jersey, and Jason and Ruhe there joining us from Niagara Falls, Ontario. That is a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in. At least 16 people have been killed and over 50 injured in an attack by Boko Haram terrorist group in Nigeria's northeastern state of Borno. Security forces say the terrorists fired two mortar shells on a densely populated city of Maiduguri. Nine of the dead were young boys who were hit while playing football. Boko Haram has repeatedly made incursions into Maiduguri, aiming to overrun the regional capital. Since gaining widespread exposure in 2009, the terror group has killed well over 36,000 people and displaced around 2 million from their homes in Nigeria. The Boko Haram insurgency has caused a dire humanitarian crisis in the region, including neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. The World Health Organization has delivered the COVID-19 vaccine shipment to Ghana, making it the first country in the world to receive shots under the organization's COVAX scheme. A flight carrying over 600,000 doses of AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine produced by an Indian firm landed in Ghana's capital, Accra. Local representatives of the WHO and the United Nations Children's Agency have described the vaccine's arrival as a momentous occasion. They also call the move a critical step in bringing the pandemic to an end. UN-backed COVAX initiative, which was launched 8 months ago, aims to ensure fair distribution of vaccines between richer and poorer nations. Under the COVAX program, UN health agencies expected to deliver some 2 billion doses of vaccines to member states by the end of the year. Officials in France have imposed new anti-COVID-19 restrictions in Dunkirk while warning of a nationwide lockdown to deal with the worsening situation of the pandemic.
The epidemic situation is very worrying, alarming even, here in Dunkirk. One out of every 100 inhabitants in the city falls ill every week from COVID to Dunkirk and the High Flanders communes. The incidence there is now double what it was at the height of the first and second wave in this territory.
A government spokesman also stated that infections have reached worrying levels in several parts of the country, and that requires rapid and strong measures. Meanwhile, Sweden announced a tightening of restrictions as well, which will include reducing opening hours of restaurants and cafes and limiting the number of people allowed in shops at a time. The Swedish Prime Minister says the situation in the country is serious as it has a high rate of infection spread, which is increasing by the day. Remarks come as Sweden registered over 5,300 new cases of the virus, highest daily jump since early January. Hundreds of Georgians have held a protest outside the jail where opposition leader Nika Melia is held, calling for his release.
Melia's detention does not serve the interests of the country and the statehood. We staged a rally to support Nika Melia. We will not give up.
The rally was held in the southeastern town of Rustavi. Demonstrators said the protest will continue until all political prisoners are liberated and snap polls are called. Melia is leader of Georgia's main opposition party, the United National Movement. He was arrested Tuesday in a violent police raid on his party's headquarters. Melia is accused of inciting violence in street protests in June of 2019, but his arrest comes against the backdrop of a wider, more recent political crisis. Georgia has been rocked by protests since parliamentary elections back in October. The opposition dismissed the polls as rigged after the ruling party, the Georgian Dream, claimed a narrow victory. Turkish main opposition party continues to question former Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak, who's also President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's son-in-law, over a central bank reserve. Erdogan says the campaign is targeting his family and their fundamental rights and freedoms. Ashan Saglam reports.
Head of Turkey's main opposition party, CHP, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, questioned the fate of $128 billion during the era of former Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak, who is also the president's son-in-law, adding that the fate of both those billions and the minister are still unknown. The main opposition also questions the whereabouts of the former minister following his disappearance from the public eye after his resignation in November 2020. Erdogan emphasized that the transactions over the central bank's reserves were carried out in accordance with the regulation.
Erdogan says that his son-in-law was very successful in office. So why did he resign from his post and disappear in this suspicious way? Once again, I address the question to President Erdogan that what has happened to the $128 billion of the central bank reserve? And why did the finance minister disappear?
Erdogan defended Albayrak as an energy minister and finance minister, saying that the reason for criticism towards Albayrak was because he was not a politician.
The resignation of former finance minister took place months ago, but the opposition continues to question the reasons behind it, and I think the issue should be viewed as part of the upcoming elections campaign.
Albayrak's abrupt resignation and his disappearance were interpreted as the government's effort to blame him for the recent financial problems the country is facing. Many also say that his father-in-law wanted him to play low-key in the meantime, for he is preparing for the 2023 elections. Observers say the resignation of Albayrak has already inflicted a heavy blow to Turkish president, and it seems that the issue could gain momentum as Turkey gets closer to the next elections. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
And we'll have to leave you with that, everyone. Thank you for tuning in at World News, and goodbye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Steel and steel products, copper and copper concentrates, cement and clinker, lead and zinc, building decoration stones, tile and ceramics are the minerals that Iran exports to neighboring countries. China, and the countries of Southeast Asia. Iran's Mines and Mineral Industries Development and Renovation Organization, IMIDRO, in cooperation with the private sector, have planned to launch new development projects worth $2.3 billion in the current Iranian year. These projects will create 8,300 jobs directly and 64,000 jobs indirectly. Thus, over 70,000 jobs will be created in this area. IMIDRO has been formed with the aim of meeting the domestic needs to mineral products in a bid to optimize the country's economic system in the mineral sector and affiliated industries, and also supervise the usage of mineral reserves and their proper exploitation. Accordingly, implementation of projects for construction, development, equipment, and renovation of industries related to production, excavation and processing of minerals, and implementation of exploration works are among the long-term goals of this organization. Mineral activities and industries enjoy competitive privileges in underdeveloped regions. Some of these privileges include potentials for the growth of investment in chain units of mine sector and mineral industries with modern technologies, and development of mineral activities and mineral industries abroad with the aim of integration of value chain in production sector. These form part of strategic activities to bolster mines and mineral industries. In view of this, like the past year, IMIDRO is implementing the project of revival of stagnant mines of private sector with a broader plan, which is an important step toward providing feed of production units and leap in production of mines and mineral industries. Last year, 146 mines were revived, part of which has entered the production sphere. It is estimated that with complete activation of these mines, 3,000 jobs will be created annually in this sector, and a notable part of the feed of processing factories will be secured from these mines. This year is also the year of yielding fruit of steel manufacturing of steel industries. Last year, Mubarakeh Steel Company and National Copper Industries Company managed to materialize the investment growth, and Golgohar Company of Sirjan has also stepped in the same route. But due to the problems caused by coronavirus outbreak, investment growth has been postponed in Golgohar. After these three companies, another huge company is in the route, namely Chador Malu in Yazd province. To this, we should add the project for production of 10 million tons of steel at the special Persian Gulf zone per year. Part of this project has been implemented, but the other part is going to be finalized with the participation of regional companies. Moreover, another project is underway in the southernmost region of the country, that is Chabahar. Once accomplished, this project will turn Makran coastlines into the hub of producing 10 million tons of steel per year. The mines and minerals have seen a two-digit growth in exports in the past year. Gigantic complex of Sangan, as the capital of Iran's iron ore, will host new factories for production of iron concentrate and iron ore. Sangan Mineral Company is going to produce 17.5 million tons of iron concentrate and 15 million tons of iron ore. Presently, Iran is one of the greatest producers of gas-based sponge iron and among the 10 producers of steel in the world. This comes while Iran has been put several times under the most brutal sanctions by the U.S. The upsurge in production, exports, explorations, and implementation of development projects promise a great leap in production in the mineral field of economy. As the mines and mineral industries are based on exploration, 400,000 kilometers have been added to the area of the related activities during the past 1.5 years. This has been unprecedented in Iran. These explorations have yielded in identification of 760 promising areas. Exploration of new mines in the country will definitely play a key role in leap in production. In spite of global sanctions orchestrated and spearheaded by the U.S., production and trade has been on the rise during the past 2 years of 1397 and 1398. However, according to the report of the Parliament's Special Commission for Support of National Production and Supervision of Implementation of Article 44 of the Constitution, the industry sector has not gained the position that it should. This comes while there are high capacities and potentials in the sector due to the high technical know-how and big number of graduates in production engineering. These potentials should be applied for boosting of production and leap in production.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kazimiya, and then later they were moved to Najaf, and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16, and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I am Atal, the host of this program. The teacher is mainly concerned with the thoughts, works, and the biographies of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and jurists all across the nation of Islam. And with me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, two dear experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Sayyid, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thanks for having me.
And Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh, thank you very much, brother, for accepting our invitation. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program, the teacher. It is very kind of you. So, up until now, we tried to cover some of the thoughts and works of the most outstanding contemporary thinkers of Islam. And for today's discussion and the upcoming ones, we want to get to Shia jurist thinkers and political activists of Iraq, Ayatollah Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you. First of all, give us a background of his biography, his lineage, this great scholar, Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, I'm happy to be talking about Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, who is a great martyr regarding whom when Saddam was assassinating him and his sister, he had said that I will not do the mistake that Yazid has done. Mm-hmm. At the time of Imam Hussein, by killing the brother and leaving alive the sister.
Wow.
So Saddam killed both brother and sister, like Shahid Sadr and Shahida Bintul Huda.
Bintul Huda, that's right.
And that was his sister. Obviously, Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, in regards to his lineage, when we talk, we know that obviously we talked about Imam Musa Sadr as well.
Yes.
The Sadr family is a famous family in Iraq, and especially the Kadhimain, the shrine of Kadhimain, obviously, they were the key holders of the shrine of Kadhimain, and also in Najaf as well. And generally, obviously, we know that if a family is a key holder of a shrine, it means that their forefathers were the main people who were basically taking care of the shrine, and they were obviously, it was in their lineage.
The Kazaman is the Persian for Al-Kazamiyya.
Al-Kazamiyya,
that's
yes.
That's right, in Kazaman. Arabic language, because in Farsi we say Kazaman, but
in Urdu as well, obviously.
In Urdu, is, yeah, but in
generally
Arabic,
generally,
yeah.
In the Shia Muslims,
yes.
They all know Kazaman. That's why we use this term,
yes.
Yes,
okay, thank you.
And also, in regards to his uncle, obviously, he was the head of the Hawda of Najaf at his time.
Yes.
So the Sadr family was a scholarly family. They had many, obviously, we can say like the scholars, jurists in their family.
Right.
So he has grown up in such a family, and he was born in Kadhimiyya or Kadhimain.
Right.
And then later they were moved to Najaf, and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard mm-hmm. from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16. Mm-hmm. And he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
That's right.
The great
yes.
jurist
yes.
at the age of 16, when he was 16 years old.
Oh.
And obviously there are many things about him to talk.
That's right. We will talk about his social and also scientific achievements more, inshallah. But Dr. Reza Zadeh, what made Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr special in his time? And even nowadays, we could see that when you talk to the, we can say, present generation of the scholars in the Hawza of Najaf, Qom and Mashhad, they remind him as a, we can say, full-scale scholar regarding the Shia Islam. He was really different, wasn't he?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, absolutely, he was one of the most outstanding and somehow one of the very different scholars that we have had, different in the sense of being such a comprehensive person in such a young age.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, and also in addition to just being a scholar, he was also a very innovative scholar.
Yes.
He had very creative
yes.
ideas
yes.
That were now his ideas are much more established, but when he posed those ideas, some of them were very new. And so this is one of the things, his comprehensiveness, the level of his knowledge, and also the different branches of knowledge that he was expert in.
That's
for
right.
example, he was very, you know, he was in the top levels of philosophy, in fiqh, in logic. And as Sayyid said, he became well-established mujtahid when he was just like a teenager. And that was unprecedented in the history,
yes.
somehow, in the history
and
of the Shia.
And approved by Ayatollah Khoui, that's great. That
yes,
would be great.
Yeah,
okay.
yeah. And he was somehow maybe the most outstanding and the greatest student of Ayatollah Khoui.
Mm-hmm.
And also in interpretation of the Quran, in ethics, in economy, Islamic
yes.
economy. He has some amazing, wonderful ideas in Islamic economy and in many different other branches of Islamic sciences.
That's all right.
So these are some of the things that make him very different.
True,
in
right.
addition to that, his political and social activities,
mm-hmm.
especially when he becomes religious authority in his youth, somehow, yeah, he was a young person when
yeah.
he becomes a religious authority in Marja.
Okay.
And
right.
that was also very special about
That's
him.
Right.
This is not something that can happen easily, especially when there are great scholars still alive, like Ayatollah Khoui and
That's
Imam
right.
Khomeini and many other scholars
mm-hmm.
at his time. But he was one of the most popular Islamic authorities of his
That's
time.
Right.
So he had a lot of political and social also activities and
okay.
ideas. These factors are some of the factors that make him very influential.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Said Mohsen Naqvi, Dr. Rezazadeh very beautifully referred to the socio-political life of Shahid Ayatollah Said Mohammad Baqir Assad. And we know that he was not a marja who is living life in solitary and just only being after the religious matter. Through religion, he wanted to reform the society of his time. And we know that in that time, the Ba'ath regime was ruling the country. We know that they prevented him from teaching Usul al-Fiqh, but he changed his courses into the exegesis of the Holy Quran. And through his exegesis of the Holy Quran, he wanted the people to uprise against the tyranny of Ba'ath regime Saddam Hussein at that time. I think this aspect of his life also made him very much different, his socio-political activities, isn't it?
It is, definitely, obviously. And at the time of the Ba'ath regime, obviously, why he became famous, got the authority, he became the authority at the teenage, when he was teenage.
Yes.
Also, he gave a fatwa against Ba'ath regime.
Hmm.
Like he said, whoever will join, it is haram, it is forbidden to join the Ba'ath regime.
That's right.
Why? Because they are under the capital system. They are not following truly Islam. Yes, they might look like Muslims. You know, the way in Iran, like there was a king who looked like Muslim, who had the names of the Muslim, but obviously he wasn't following the Islam, and Imam Khomeini raised against him. Similarly, Shahid Sadr, he gave this fatwa, and it was very famous. And because of this fatwa, the Ba'ath regime, they arrested him. And they did not allow him to give the lectures.
That's right.
And that's how like he went towards the Quran, and that was the main reason. But obviously, he was very much involved with the people, obviously, in Hizb ud-Da'wah.
Yes.
And
what was this Hizb ud-Da'wah al-Islami? We can't say it was a party, political party.
It was a political party as well, and it was mainly made by the general people to protect themselves, basically. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the Ba'ath regime was killing, they were assassinating the Shia population.
Yes.
And obviously, in regards to that, obviously, and because Saddam had a kind of martial law in Iraq, obviously, you know that he was a president, but he was an army man, and he was the general as well.
Yes.
So he had his own army. He was handling everything. It was kind of a martial law in Iraq. So they wanted to basically overthrow this situation, and they wanted to get involved into the politics as well, so that the people can basically decide for their country, so
that's
that the people can get the freedom.
Okay.
So it was a call for freedom, and it was, you can say, a struggle for freedom, basically.
Yeah. And Dr. Rezazadeh, from one side, we see Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Baqir Assad protecting, establishing such societies and associations like Hizb ud-Da'wah Islami and Jamaatul Ulama, and also from the other side, supporting the movement of the late Imam Khomeini. So he was concerned with both sides, I think.
Yes.
Socio-political activities of the leaders of his region, especially the Muslims. And what is important about Shahid Baqir Assad is having a model in the mind in order to establish a kind of religious Islamic authority, pure Muhammadan Islam in the region and in the Muslim lands like Iraq, Iran, and the other Muslim lands. That's why when we look at his books, for example, Iqtisaduna, Our Economics, Falsafatuna, Our Philosophy, we could see that he has a really model and a plan in his mind. And this made him very much different from the other religious authorities of his time, isn't it, brother?
Yes, that's very true. Actually, we can divide the political activities of Shahid Saad into two main branches or groups. The first one was the political activities that he had in Iraq. And the main example of that was establishment of Islamic Da'wah Party.
That's right.
And the other branch, or the other example of his political activities, was his support from the Islamic Revolution Iran and its leader, Imam Khomeini.
Both was very fresh, of course, on that time.
Of course. And both of these two activities were very controversial, and naturally, it was very risky to do such a thing at that time, especially at the time of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq
And the Pahlavi regime in Iran.
And Pahlavi regime in Iran. And we see that as a result, at the end of the day, he was killed and he was martyred.
Yes.
And he was actually, he was tortured and then martyred because of these activities. So, yeah, we can say. But the point is that the point that you were mentioned is, and that was also very important. Mm. You know, here we can see a person with a systematic mind and with a systematic life, and everything in his activities follow some rules that are very clear. Mm-hmm. For example, when we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that he has a model, as you said.
Yes.
He has a plan.
Yes.
And all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Mm-hmm.
He has a mission. And because of that mission, he's making a system. And he's trying to somehow modernize. He's trying to somehow modernize his activities.
That's right.
By following the systems that are well accepted in the modern world. For example, establishment of a party, you know, for a scholar, for a faqih at that time was something very new.
Or being concerned with the economics of Islam, you know, this is very important. I mean, because we know that on that time, the capitalism was growing in the West. And I think Shahid Saad's knowledge about the world was really outstanding. He had a view of what's happening outside the Muslim lands and then affecting the Muslim land's system of thought too. That's why he felt this responsibility and found himself accountable in order to introduce some new models into the socio-political and also economic system of the Muslim land.
Yes, and that is something that it was clearly mentioned when they were establishing the party. They said one of the main reasons that they established the party was to promote Islamic values and also defend Islam from secularism and communism and all of those, let's say...
The capitalist approach and the communist approach to the economics on that
Yeah,
time.
And all and all of those new schools of thoughts, that one of their works was to invade or attack Islamic values.
That's all right.
So one of the main reasons that they established that party was to defend Islam, combat secularism, and create an Islamic state in Iraq.
That's all right.
You know, they were, they had this very important idea that without having an Islamic state, based on a systematic school of thought, which is rooted in the Islamic jurisprudence, we cannot fulfill and we cannot establish an Islamic society.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much. And we know that it was Jamadil Awal 22nd on the year 1400. According to the Hijri calendar, the Bas regime arrested him. At the beginning, they thought that they could reconcile him, you know, by permitting the people in order to join Hizb al-Bas. He did not accept it. Do not support Islamic Republic of Iran and the late Imam Khomeini. He did not accept it. And this was 2 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. And also Hizb al-Dawah, you know.
You know, and he had a fatwa that joining Hizb al-Bas is
haram
for every Muslim.
Yeah, this was
so
the fatwa.
So one of the reasons that they arrested him, because they wanted to force him to get this fatwa back and say this is, it's okay to join this.
Yeah.
And
he did not accept it, and after, they say, 3 hard days of torture in the prisons, he and his sister, he got martyred, and his burial place has been changed many times in several places, but it's still in the minds of many scholars and the people of Iraq.
And he was only 46 years old.
Yeah, only 46 years old. We really missed an outstanding mastermind. He could, we could really benefit a lot. And, you know, from his thoughts, from the new models that he had in his mind. And Imam Khomeini also issued a message that we missed one of the most outstanding masterminds of the Islamic Hausa, which the Islamic Hausa could never seen at all in the modern century. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Rezazadeh and Said Mohsen Nahvi, for a nice introduction to the life and works of Shahid Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Assad. It was very kind of you. We will continue our discussion with some of his important thoughts in upcoming sessions of the program. Please visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the midst of a national shortage of N95 masks, the US government quietly granted an exception to its export ban on protective gear, allowing as many as 5 million of the masks per month to be shipped overseas. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Christina Jewett, correspondent at Kaiser Health News. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Workers Cried Out for More Masks. The government allowed N95 exports anyway. Here's more. In the midst of a national shortage of N95 masks, the U.S. government quietly granted an exception to its export ban on protective gear, allowing as many as 5 million of the masks per month to be shipped overseas. The Federal Emergency Management Agency issued the waiver in the final moments of Donald Trump's presidency last month, allowing a Texas company to export its products after it failed to secure U.S. customers, according to FEMA letter obtained by KHN. National Nurses United President Zanny Trunfo-Cortez called the export waiver unconscionable and said N95s remain under lock and key in many hospitals. She said she still has to beg for a new N95 if hers gets soiled during a shift caring for COVID-19 patients. Healthcare employers and a federal agency that is supposed to be protecting the people of America are not doing their jobs, she said. They have no regard for American people's safety. The disconnect between frontline workers going without better protection and federal officials suddenly exporting masks boils down to one thing, workplace safety experts say. The government has not pivoted quickly enough to lift supply chain crisis mode guidelines and force employers to take costly and sometimes cumbersome steps to better protect workers with top quality gear. The FEMA letter references the challenge that Fort Worth-based Prestige Ameritech faced in finding customers for its government-approved high-end respirators. Hospitals did not want to fit test employees to its N95s, a 15-minute process per employee to ensure that a new N95 model seals to the face, according to company president Mike Bowen. Bowen said he ramped up N95 production during the pandemic from 75,000 to 9.6 million per month. Lately, he said he can't sell them to major buyers, does not have the infrastructure to sell them to small buyers, and has so many in storage that he may need to lay off workers and wind down production. The FEMA letter references those challenges and says the waiver was granted in the national defense interest to ensure he keeps production running at pace. The letter was transmitted to Border Patrol officials who oversee exports 103 minutes before Joe Biden was sworn into office. Yet even with the waiver, Bowen said he hasn't been able to find an overseas buyer. He said he can't understand the contradictory information he is getting. Frontline workers say they need more N95s, but hospitals say they don't. There is a disconnect someplace, and I don't know where it is, Bowen said. Why aren't my phones ringing off the hook if there is a shortage? A FEMA official said by email that the waiver could be revoked at any time if U.S. demand increases and that the agency could require the company to satisfy domestic demand before exporting N95s. Although prices fall considerably for those buying in bulk, prices for smaller lots of N95s have reached $4 to $7 each, according to Get Us PPE, a nonprofit meant to match frontline workers with needed gear. The requirement for employers to perform fit tests annually was set aside amid the public health emergency, giving employers little incentive to veer from the industry standard models like 3M that were used for years. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has left guidelines in place that say a limited cadre of healthcare workers should get N95s, which can be reused and rationed. That adds up to an unusual situation in which U.S. mask supplies have surged, but employers' motivation to buy the best protective gear has not, said Peg Seminario, a former union health and safety official who recently signed a letter urging the CDC to update its guidelines to reflect the risk of inhaling the virus. "This is crazy," she said. "We could crush this pandemic where the biggest risks of infection are, and we are not doing it." Started by a group of emergency room doctors in March, Get Us PPE said it gets 89% of requests for gear, often N95s, from health workers outside of hospitals like community clinics, COVID testing sites, and psychiatric care facilities. Demand rose throughout January with 28% of frontline workers seeking N95s reporting that their site had none. Yet the volunteer-run group has been able to fulfill only about 15% of the requests it receives. Dr. Ali Raja, a founder of the group and executive vice chair of the emergency department at Massachusetts General Hospital, said the need is vast outside of hospitals, but a small facilities scrambling for gear are not connecting to bulk sellers like Bowen's firm. "There was nothing out there. no centralized place for all facilities to base data on this. We want that to be the federal government. On the last day of 2020, FEMA extended its rule prohibiting anyone from exporting PPE, including N95s, without first getting express approval from the agency. The rule says the fall and winter surge in COVID cases meant domestic supply of allocated PPE has not kept pace with demand and is not anticipated to do so. The U.S. Strategic National Stockpile has not yet met its goal for N95 respirators, according to a U.S. Government Accountability Office report. The report said that as of December 18th, there were 190 million N95 respirators in storage, well short of its goal of 300 million. GAO remains deeply troubled that agencies have not acted on recommendations to more fully address critical gaps in the medical supply chain, the government watchdog report says. Another twist to the saga is that millions of counterfeit N95s stamped 3M, an industry standard that has long been used in previously required annual fit tests, have flooded hospital shelves even as federal agents rush to seize them at U.S. ports. A prominent group of scientists wrote to the CDC recently to point out guidelines that urgently need to be changed to protect workers from inhaling tiny airborne virus particles. Their letter noted that the CDC does not recommend the use of N95 respirators outside healthcare settings, even though outsized risks are documented for bus drivers, prison guards, and meatpacking staffers. CDC guidelines also allow hospitals to limit which workers get the N95s, leaving out those in community setting and lower-level workers who typically spend the most time next to patients. In the Loss on the Frontline project, KHN and The Guardian have documented the deaths of hundreds of more than 3,440 frontline health workers, of whom 2 in 3 were workers of color and 56% worked outside of hospitals. For more than 120 who died, family members had concerns about PPE, including the extensive reuse of N95s or the use of surgical masks for direct care of COVID patients.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.